there was perhaps only one person or one small group of people who were with Jesus and saw all that happened in those final 16, 12 hours of his life. It was not his disciples. They were there when Jesus was arrested in the garden, but as the soldiers arrested him, we're told that they fled and ran away. Two of them snuck in to the house of to the court of the high priest to witness this trial going on, but instead got embroiled as one of them, Peter, was recognized multiple times and found himself denying his knowledge of Jesus. It wasn't his accusers. Despite their rage against him, they didn't even witness all that happened. But they would come to the house, they would bring him to the house of Pilate to be charged, and yet, because they didn't want to defile themselves, to be unable to celebrate the Passover, they did not enter his house. So they stayed outside while Pilate questioned Jesus. It wasn't even the women who seemed to be there throughout Jesus' life, just behind the scenes, witnessing, seeing, giving testimony to all that Jesus has done. Perhaps the only people that saw all that happened to Jesus was the centurion or the soldiers who walked with him on this journey. We know nothing about this centurion, or we know very little about him. As far as we know, he never appears again in Scripture. There are other centurions that come up in the stories and other parts in the New Testament, but at no point does it tell us that it was this centurion again. There were many centurions. He only occurs here. We do not know his name. We don't know what his nationality. What we do know is that he was a leader of approximately 100 men. That's where his name, centurion, comes from. Given charge over these soldiers and these troops. It's likely that he came to this position because he worked his way up through the ranks, beginning as just an ordinary soldier, but because he showed himself and his fierceness in battle, his ability to lead, he gained the trust of his men and the confidence of his commanders. We don't know how he led. Some lead by, consensus, and people follow them. Perhaps he led with a heavy hand, and people followed him out of fear of what could happen. What we do know is he was given charge over this scene. And he was there at the cross, as multiple gospel writers recount him and the soldiers there witnessing the scene. Was he there when Jesus was in the garden? We're told that Roman soldiers came, used by the high priest to arrest Jesus. There in the middle of the night, did he ask questions? Why are we doing this in the middle of the night? I would much rather be sleeping. Did he ask the question that we recorded? After all, Jesus every single day is in the temple courts, there in public, there in broad daylight, and yet we have to do this in the middle of the night? But he's a soldier who follows orders. Maybe he never even asked. Was it there when Peter grabs his sword and wildly swings it at the servant of the high priest? What was his reaction? Did he unsheath his own weapon? Did he and his men surge forward, or did they step back, perhaps feeling outnumbered and deciding to take a defensive position? Whatever their reaction, they heard Jesus declare, "Stop," intervenes and brings calm to it all. "Those who live by the sword will die by the sword." Perhaps the motto of the Roman soldier. He's grateful when finally they're out of the garden, but they take him to the house of Caiaphas, the high priest. And he's stuck there throughout the night, listening back and forth, as arguments about the minutiae of their laws goes back and forth. And maybe he's fed up with it all. "I'm tired of these people. I just want to go to sleep." And yet they're arguing, and there's false claims against Jesus going on. And Jesus doesn't give answer to any of it, and he doesn't understand it. Finally, somebody accuses Jesus of blasphemy of the temple, and that is the thing, and the crowds begin to stir up. And the adrenaline pumps, and maybe a bit of gratefulness, they decide they're going to send him to Pilate, and so he's able to, with his troops, to move Jesus away. Happy to be back within the palace, happy to be back in familiar territory and away from these people. But there he witnesses this trial take place, as Pilate questions Jesus. Jesus doesn't respond like other criminals that he has seen there questioned and challenged. Some come in groveling, pleading their innocence, pleading for mercy. All sense of self-dignity is gone. They beg and they plead for their life. Others instead come in just spewing vulgarity, and anger and rage wells up in them. Those are the easy ones to execute. But Jesus doesn't respond in either way. And again, he watches this debate and dialogue go on between Jesus and Pilate. "So you're king," he says. "This is the reason I was born," Jesus would say. "You're the Son of God, a son of a God." He sees Pilate get nervous about this. Leads him out to the crowd. He, like Pilate, can't see any reason why this man needs to be executed. At worst, he's a madman, but certainly not a person worthy of execution, not the brutality of Rome. He brings him out in front of the crowd and they call out, "Crucify him, crucify him." Doesn't understand. Maybe he's the one that Pilate gives the order to. Go take him and beat him. Maybe we can pacify the crowd, and hands him over to his soldiers, and they beat Jesus, and now they take this broken and bloody body and they bring it out and they put it in front of the crowd. Maybe this is enough. Yet the crowd is enraged. It's like sharks who tasted blood in the water. Instead of being pacified, it makes them rage, and they claw out even more and more, "Crucify him." And he watches Jesus' reaction to all of this that's going on. He's never seen a man quite go through like this. Even though he's under the heavy oppression of Rome, even though he's under the guard of the centurion, his soldiers, there is a sense in which he is the one who is commanding what is happening. And that Pilate and he and the chief priests are pawns in a story that he doesn't understand. Perhaps he's the one given the charge of finally carrying out the crucifixion. Maybe it is he who chooses the three squads of four. We're told there are four men at the feet of the cross. They'll gamble away for Jesus' clothes. Why not let them? The task of a crucifixion is a horrible thing. Why not let his men have a little bit of fun in the midst of it? We don't know much about this man. We assume he's a man who's acquainted with death. He's a soldier. He's earned his place in command. He's been in battle. He's heard the cries of people plead for mercy, those suffering from wounds that they will not recover. He's heard the sound of death as one takes his final breath. He's been in battle. He's suffered the scars. But this isn't like anything that he's seen before. And there at the base of the cross, he watches all that's going on. He sees the religious leaders, and those come by, they mock and they taunt Jesus. "He saved others. Why can't he save himself? Come down from the cross, and we will see and believe," they say. He sees his mother grieving around them. And then there's what happens on the crosses. First, there are two men on each side. They hurl insults at Jesus, taunting at him. Maybe he even joins in the taunting himself. But as the day progresses on, one of the men begins to shift, and he instead calls out to Jesus, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus says to him, "Today you'll be with me in paradise." He's never had a conversation like that happen on crosses. Who is this man that he has crucified? Then there's the darkness. Mark says from about 12 to 3, for about 3 hours, darkness descends upon the earth. And in that darkness, he hears Jesus say, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." Who is it that Jesus is speaking about? Forgive? Is it the religious leaders? They certainly seem to know what they're doing. But yet they've crucified this man. Is it the crowd that he calls out for forgiveness for? They've been stirred up into a frenzy by their leaders. participating in a murder and don't even realize what they're doing. Is this who he calls out to forgive? What about him? And why would Jesus need to forgive him? He's not done anything wrong. He is a soldier who is following orders. He is doing his responsibility. This is not his fault. But that call for forgiveness unnerves him and unseats him. Then the end. The cry on the cross. Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, Father. It's not Father, forgive them. help me out here, I'm blank. My God, why have you forsaken me? Thank you. My God, why have you forsaken me? And Jesus calls out his final breath, and as he dies, the earth shakes. And Matthew says the soldiers there are in fear. They're terrified by what is going on around them. And it's there that the man says, this soldier, surely this man was the Son of God. Now your NIV says it that way, surely this man was the Son of God. In Greek, as many will say, it's not nearly as precise. There's no definite article there, and it's not necessary that it be there. It's just as likely the man declared, surely this man was a son of a God. Perhaps as a Roman, that is the most likely testimony that he gave. Surely he was a son of God. For his worldview believed there were many gods. Caesar himself, the man that he had sworn allegiance to, the man that he gave his life to every single day, was a son of God, he believed. But he watched how Jesus died. Ironic, the religious leaders would say, come down from the cross and we will see and believe. But this man saw how Jesus died, and he believed. And he gave a testimony. And it's strange that it's a Roman soldier who is the first to see and identify who Jesus is. But it's an incomplete testimony. He has no idea that in his declaration that this man is a son of God, that this is the one who said, let there be light. And it was his breath that breathed into the lungs of Adam and Eve and brought life to humanity. He has no idea that this is the one who parted the waters in his own and led a nation through. He has no idea that this is the one born of Mary in a stable. It's an incomplete testimony, but in it there is truth. It's like, as a pastor, a few times I've had the opportunity, I've done a few weddings, and I've done a few vow renewals. And there's a lot of similarity between these two ceremonies, but there is one big dramatic difference. See, when you do a wedding, especially when you got two young people standing up here in the front, and we go through the vows, and we all know basically how the vows go. They make this commitment in sickness and in health, in rich, for richer, for poorer. Good times, bad times, till death do we part, they make this vow. And we all celebrate it and we all smile at them. And those of us, it's been a few years, know they haven't a clue what they are agreeing to. And yet we make those vows. It's an incomplete vow. It's honest, it's true. But we don't know what we're getting into. And so when you do a vow renewal, it's a wholly different experience. People that have lived 40, 50, 60 years together. And now they look back at all of the years. It was better than they ever expected and harder than they ever expected. There was richness and there was poverty. There was sickness and there was health. And now they look back at all that they've been through. Times when they nearly gave up, they didn't. And they say, those vows again. This time it's looking back and saying, I would do it all over again. Knowing everything that it meant, I would do it again. The soldier is only given a beginning vow, and it's true, but he has no idea what he has declared. than all that it means, but all that it could mean for him. E. Stanley Jones, in his sermon, Alive in Christ, he speaks about, and he says that every cult turns in, has a way of turning on itself and turning its people on itself. He says, like a cult of materialism says that money is Lord. The cult of consumerism says stuff is Lord. The cult of nationalism, he says nation is Lord. The cult of pleasure says the thrills are Lord. And the cult of self says I am Lord. But he says there is this declaration which divides and cuts between these two. It's an incomplete declaration, yet it is everything. And that is the declaration that Jesus is Lord. And in light of that declaration, that testimony, and that truth that Jesus is Lord, life begins to make sense. And the pieces of the puzzle come together. We turn back to the cross, if you will. Put yourself there in the place of the soldier, witnessing all that is going on, witnessing the trial that is happening, witnessing Jesus on the cross, hearing his cry of forgiveness, seeing his death, and look on it and say, Jesus is Lord. And suddenly what didn't make any sense begins to make sense. And what we couldn't understand gets clarity. And in the impossible situations in our own life, the struggles, the walls we cannot get over, the sin we cannot defeat, the sickness that lingers, declare Jesus is Lord. It's an incomplete testimony, and yet it says everything. And in those words, we begin to get clarity and begin to see truth and understand. Jesus is Lord. And if he is Lord, everything else makes sense. Everything else is answered. And so we declare together, Jesus is Lord. Would you pray with me?